welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, February the 20th, 2021. I do hope you're all well and staying safe. The music this week is a set of nimble fiddle tunes from Scotland, played by a quartet of young women who hail from the Orkneys. They call their band Farah, which is also the name of the CD. This track is a medley of the tunes Where's Neil, Up Dust Rood, and The Man Who Shot the Windmill. They've kindly allowed us to play it on Talking Newspapers. As usual, you'll be able to hear it in full at the end of the programme. I should mention that Farah will be playing at the Kympton Folk Festival, which the organisers of which I am one, very much hope will take place in July, government rules permitting. This week, following the news stories and radio listings, we have Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes, followed by two articles from Hearts Life magazine. The first of these is the inspiring story of Marianne Rupre, who after a car crash left her paralysed, has battled back to regain mobility and help others. The second is about one of our Cold War secrets, the county's underground nuclear bunkers. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Anne, Dominic, Caroline and Gilly.
Hello, I'm Caroline. I'm here to tell you about Club Batchwood, who have been hailed as one of the best performing COVID vaccination centres in Britain. The vaccination team at Club Batchwood have been congratulated by Health Secretary Matt Hancock for being one of the best performing centres in Britain. The clinic at Batchwood Hall, which has been administering jabs since December, has gained national recognition for its valiant efforts in combating COVID-19. In a letter to St Albans MP and Deputy Lib Dem leader Daisy Cooper on February the 3rd, Matt Hancock congratulated Club Batchwood for now having vaccinated all over 80s in the system. Mr Hancock also praised the speed of the vaccine rollout and the fantastic efforts of the Batchwood Centre. He added, "This is down to the tireless efforts of all those involved, especially those on the ground in our communities, from nurses to GPs to pharmacies to volunteers and so many more. It's incredible to see this community spirit as people pull together to lead us collectively out of the pandemic." Daisy said, "Our local GPs totally deserve this national recognition for their brilliant work in getting Batchwood Centre up and running. I saw for myself the amazing work of the GPs, primary care staff and many community volunteers in setting up this new service at incredible speed. They have all done us proud. I'm also continuing to bang the drum about needing more vaccine supply so Batchwood can open for more than 2 days a week." Chris White, Lib Dem leader of the St Albans Council, said, "I'm pleased the District Council was able to give its support, not just in providing the building, but also with the speedy work in setting up the centre. I'm also proud of the tremendous effort Liberal Democrat councillors and activists have put in at Batchwood and at other centres in Harpenden and throughout the district." Joint clinical lead, Dr Helen McAndrew, added, "We're pleased to see the Secretary of State recognising the role of primary care in delivering this critical public health service to our community. Our success is down to the hard work, collaboration and can-do attitude of all 8 general practices, the local district council, community volunteers and other organisations, including businesses who have donated much-needed supplies in order to keep our momentum going."
Hello, I'm Gilly. And this article is headed, "Lockdown 3.0, How are St Albans Businesses Faring?" After months of lockdowns and other pandemic measures, the pressures on our local business owners have not eased, and if anything, they have got worse. So how are they coping with the current restrictions, and what are they doing to ensure they survive and thrive in the coming months? We spoke to a selection of independent retailers to catch up on what they've been up to and find out their plans for the future. Terry Harrington from Raindrops on Roses said, To be honest, things have been tough for us since closing our doors for lockdown 3.0, and January is always our quietest month. But we're lucky that we've had quite a few online sales and they're really picking up now. This period has given us time to work on our website and look for new products for spring and summer. We've had lots of lovely messages of support from customers and passers-by when we've been open for click and collect, and by email and through our website. It's given us a real boost. It does feel people are shopping local more than in the past, which is really encouraging for the future of our local high street. Alison Lloyd of Jewellers Amalilli in George Street said, "St Albans has a strong and supportive local community, and it's been amazing how everyone has supported each other. Since our doors closed, I've used the time to streamline the online shop, innovate and move the business forward with the launch of a new clothing line, which is really exciting for us. And I'm doing all I can to keep connected with customers, our followers on social media, and subscribers from our website, which I think is really important during lockdown. It's been fun keeping creative by dressing the shop windows regularly so people can enjoy a little visual feast on their daily walk. Far from resting, I'm in store for click and collect services, packaging orders for delivery 5 days a week, and to keep planning our future plans. I firmly believe that the people of St Albans value their high street and the premium service and unique products on offer, but we need support now so that we are still here offering that same exclusivity when we come out on the other side. It's all too easy to shop with the faceless online giants when we are all cooped up at home, but local businesses are open and can provide unusual products with a much better service. St Albans will one day soon be thriving, with our quaint streets busy with tourists, and it will all be thanks to the local community that came together and got us all through. Donna Nicol from High Street Boutique Chloe James said, "This lockdown seems even tougher than previous ones, probably partly because of the miserable weather. January and February are always a difficult time of year for retail, but being closed takes that to a whole new level. I think there's the general fatigue that everyone is feeling, a sort of, here we go again. But at the same time, I'm pleased to see people mostly adhering to the restrictions. None of us wants another lockdown after this one." She said one of the positives to come out of the current lockdown is that their online business is booming. As well as serving our local customers, this has taken us to a national audience. Whilst I'm absolutely thrilled about this, I'm really looking forward to a return to business as usual in the shop. It's vital to the local community that our city centre remains a vibrant and lovely place to be. Nothing is more depressing than rows and rows of boarded up shops. I'm really hoping that the business rates holiday is extended to enable retailers to get back on their feet.
Hello, my name is Anne. And this article is headed, "This Week, the City's Independent Businesses are Desperate to Learn the Prime Minister's Plans for Coming Out of the Latest Lockdown, Due to Be Revealed on Monday, in Order to Better Prepare for When They Are Allowed to Reopen." Tony Early of Early's Boutique in George Street said, "The third lockdown has made life hard. The stop-start nature of the lockdown means we have a considerable amount of stock left. We have gone online, and I have done personal Zoom styling sessions for a couple of customers, and we had a few sales for Valentine's. However, I would like clear and decisive dates for the end of lockdown, as suppliers wish to deliver spring outfits, and I have declined so far." Jane Lewis, owner of the Skin to Love Clinic in Checker Street, agreed. "The third lockdown is, of course, demoralising for all businesses, but we have a responsibility to help stop the spread of COVID and to keep our staff and clients safe. We've taken this as an opportunity to continue learning, improve the business, and to keep up to date with the ever-evolving aesthetics industry that we're in so that we can come back even stronger than we were before. Currently, we're supporting our clients online, and we're able to offer video consultations to those who wish to discuss their skin and possible treatments in preparation for when we can safely reopen. Mike Nuttall of Must Wine in George Street said, "We have worked tirelessly since March last year to always deliver new and exciting products for local residents to enjoy. Our weekly online tastings have been loved far and wide and have proved a real winner for family, friends, companies, and just because." Antonia Mason from Books on the Hill said they have spent this lockdown ensuring the shop has an interesting and engaging online presence through their website and social media accounts. She said, "We have been organising a wide variety of events from book clubs to author talks to family-friendly book quizzes. Our latest book quiz for Bloomsbury's 7th annual Harry Potter Book Night had an incredible 80-plus participants. This fun event provided both children and adults with an engaging evening of Harry Potter trivia. The shop has lots of author events lined up in the next few weeks. On Friday, February the 26th, we have a wonderful event planned with author Nadine Matheson to talk about her new crime thriller book, The Jigsaw Man. Throughout March, we also have a number of author talks planned. For more details, please see our website. Some of our social media posts have been taking book selling to the extreme with some winter wild swimming and wonderful woodland walks. We have also posted some great author content into our Instagram page. For LGBTQ History Month, children's author Sarah Hagerholt read a snippet from her latest book, Proud of Me, to post onto our Instagram. Her book covers discussions for children around LGBTQ themes. We have also been posting regularly on our website blog with weekly blog posts and book recommendations from all our staff.
Hello, my name is Dominic. This story has the headline, New Plan Hopes to Reverse Fortunes of Loss-Making Charter Market. And it is accompanied by a picture of a busy, bustly St. Albans charter market on a bright, clear, sunny day with lots of people milling around. Fierce debate continues to rage over plans to replace stalls with gazebos at St. Albans charter market, part of a concerted bid to ensure it makes a profit for the first time in a decade. The market has accumulated more than £600,000 in losses in the last 5 years, with the bulk of the cost blamed on the existing market stalls, according to the Lib Dem-controlled District Council. Market profits have been in decline for many years. In 2013-2014, the combined income of the twice-weekly charter market and loss-making monthly farmers market was 36% lower than 2012-13 and 46% lower than in 2011-2012. In a bid to stem the decline, the Conservative-run administration introduced a 5-year market development plan in 2015, which included the introduction of foodie stalls in Market Place and proposals for pop-up stalls. But despite efforts, losses snowballed out of control over the following years. Subsidies of approximately £200,000 per annum have been pumped into the market, but with council revenues in decline due to the pandemic, continuing this approach is no longer considered viable. Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Tourism and Culture on the District Council, explained their strategy. "Once we get through the next few months, we hope to have lovely uniform gazebos, which is how medieval markets were often run. There is selling space on three sides during warmer weather for increased sales opportunities for traders and to help with social distancing, and the market traders are much happy with the colour scheme. We also have an enhanced marketing and promotion strategy to deliver footfall for our traders, plus a waiting list, including some of our local pubs and restaurants, all keen to operate on the new gazebo market. It's also cheaper to run. The Conservative opposition has complained about these changes, which is ironic given the catalyst for the restructuring stems from their poor management oversight of market finances and operations and failure to implement their own plan. She said moving to a permanent gazebo market with fixed pitches will save up to £500,000 per year through a combination of reduced fixed costs and no longer having to fund a deficit. We can, very rapidly, turn what was being subsidised into break-even or potentially back to being profitable such that the profits can be reinvested in marketing and promoting the market, which increases footfall. We will future-proof our market through the use of gazebos and setting up an online market offering because pandemics are not going away. Reserves can then be built up and then the gazebo decision can be revisited in the next few years. Last year, the council moved from a cash-based collection system for pitch fees to near cashless, and from April, we'll be implementing pay-in-advance fees consistent with the majority of other markets around the country to discourage empty pitches when it rains. Contracts for fixed pitches will be entered into with traders and a lease secured with market landowner Harts County Council in a bid to remove most of the £112,000 annual business rate expense. A business rate appeal is also underway to hopefully recoup a portion of the £235,000 annual rate paid since 2017, a figure higher than some London markets. Councillor McNeill added, "Our initiatives will turn market finances around. These are initiatives which could have been implemented under the previous administration if they'd implemented the objectives and recommendations in their own market development plan. Had they done so, our market would have been better placed financially to face the pandemic and the new paradigm. We might not have had to cut services like free green waste disposable for residents either. Our new market structure combines prudent financial management with innovation and will deliver increased footfall to our vibrant city centre at a lower cost for the benefit of our traders, businesses and residents. Plans to redevelop the market depot in Drover's Way have been recommended for further examination by the District Council's Planning Resources, Housing and Commercial Scrutiny Committee when the charter market consultation has been concluded.
Plans for the rebuilding of Watford General Hospital and redevelopment of St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead Hospitals on existing sites have been backed by a County Council watchdog group. At a meeting of the West Harts Hospital Trust Health Infrastructure Plan Topic Group on February the 8th, the group discussed the Trust options to redevelop buildings on existing sites. West Harts Hospital Trust is working to deliver the new buildings by 2025 or soon after. The Trust is now in the process of developing an outline business case, which is the second of a three-stage business case and approval process. The Topic Group, working on behalf of the Scrutiny Committee, decided to recommend a number of key lines of inquiry, including agreeing with the broad proposal and rationale for the rebuild of Watford General Hospital and the redevelopment of St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead Hospitals on the existing sites. The meeting heard from Kevin Minier, Chairman of the Decorum Patients Group, as well as Steve Day of Harts Valley Hospital. Speaking on behalf of HVH, which he said represents 9,000 people, Mr. Day told the group there had been massive amounts of resistance to this programme. In fact, I am not aware of anybody apart from local councillors and people in the NHS who actually support this programme. Helen Brown, Deputy Chief Executive of West Harts Hospital NHS Trust, said, "A substantial new build at Watford would bring fantastic opportunities to improve services. St Albans will be our main surgical and cancer care site. It already is the site where we do a lot of planned surgeries and where we want to develop and enhance that service offer at St Albans. One of the key things we want to do in St Albans is improve and increase the amount of diagnostics provision there to support planned care pathways and a much better coordinated model. At St Albans, we are in discussion at the moment with the CCG about urgent care provision and would expect there would be some provision in relation to urgent care for St Albans going forward on the site." She added that Hemel Hempstead will continue to be the main site for medical specialities. Commenting about the meeting, a spokesman for the New Hospital Campaign group called it a farce, adding that it reached truly bizarre conclusions. In response to the NHC comment, Chairman of the topic group, Councillor Richard Fake, said, "I absolutely believe we have accurately performed the functions and any arguments that might arise around that constitution need to go via the parliamentary or judicial process route."
Couples speak of new build woes as Kingsbury Gardens home brings nothing but issues. Moving into a new build over an older property, you would think, as everything was sparkling new, there would be no glaring issues with the house, but that was far from reality for one St Albans couple. Young couple Matt Eden and Nicola Norton moved into their new home in Kingsbury Gardens in May 2019 and have faced nothing but issues since. There are probably people who have bought worse houses, but our frustration has just bowled us over, Matt said of their uphill struggle to remedy the multitude of problems plaguing their home. The couple had been warned of buying a new build and were aware there may be a few snags here and there, but they didn't quite realise the extent of the problems or how poor the quality of the build was. Originally marketed as a Charles Church property, they didn't believe there was any cause for concern after hearing glowing reviews about them. But little did they know, Persimmon, a company they had tried to avoid, were the builders behind their home all along. Had we maybe done a bit more research and realised actually it was Persimmon behind it, we probably wouldn't have bought it, Nicola said. The couple welcomed their daughter Ellie in March 2020 and had hoped that the majority of issues would be resolved before she came along. But even now, 20 months after their original move-in date, Matt explained that passing the buck and lack of taking ownership has stopped resolutions materialising. They're very good with delay tactics. They've got every trick in the trade going to not do anything or not repair anything. They're very clever at what they do. And it's not superficial and surface-deep issues Nicola and Matt have been facing since moving into their Kingsbury Gardens home. There are a lot of cosmetic issues, but for us, the main stuff is structural. Not being able to use your shower, not being able to use your washing machine. They just really don't care. Someone has fitted the washing machine in this house and the kitchen cabinet door on it and known that they've not plugged it in and just not done anything about it because they've not put an electric socket on the wall. Matt added, "We really tried to give them deadlines to get things fixed because we didn't want the disruption for when Ellie was born. And since she was born, there's been the ongoing disruption to life. It's very frustrating." Joking about the work-home balance that comes with the ongoing pandemic and that it's hard to get a 10-month-old to sleep anyway, Matt and Nicola said the poor quality of the doors in their home mean that the lightest sounds wake their daughter up and has a real impact on not just their personal but professional lives too. Documenting their woes on Instagram, Nicola's posting has gathered a following of people facing similar strife. Matt said, "They feel the same and are going through exactly the same problems. There are a lot of new build developments going on. I think that it's something that needs to be looked at to improve other people's experiences in future." A spokesperson from Persimmon Homes Essex said, "We apologise unreservedly to Miss Norton and will ensure that any remaining concerns are addressed as quickly as possible. We have had a number of discussions with Miss Norton and have appointments already booked in to address them. We will continue to work closely with Miss Norton to reach a satisfactory conclusion."
Boys raise over £5,000 with running challenge for threatened habitats. Friends Sam and Seb, who took on a mammoth 30-day running challenge in support of the World Land Trust, have smashed their fundraising targets, which will go towards saving over 500 acres of threatened habitats. Finishing up their mission on Sunday, February the 7th, 8-year-old Sam and 7-year-old Seb ran 202.1 kilometres for the International Conservation Charity. At the time of publication, the duo's challenge has raised £5,770. They originally set out to raise £2,021. Along the way, the boys, both from St Albans, have attracted the attention of celebs, including cricketers Michael Vaughan and Ashley Giles, as well as wildlife TV presenter and conservationist Chris Packham. Cricket fanatics Sam and Seb also ran the equivalent of 3 kilometres between wickets, winning the hearts of the cricketing legends. Upon completing the challenge, Sam said, "It's been a brilliant 30-day challenge that I've enjoyed doing with my friend. We've raised over £5,500 for the World Land Trust charity and had so much support and donations. We'll remember it for the rest of our lives. It's not too late to make a difference." Sam's mum, Rebecca, added, "I'm so proud of them both. They set themselves a challenge and stuck to it. Not even the rain, snow and ice stopped them. They've won the support from people far and wide, the UK, USA, Vietnam and Australia. The charity couldn't have been more supportive, and the boys have shown that nobody is too young to take on climate change and animal extinctions." Seb told the Hearts ad, "I really wanted to help the planet, and I'm so glad Sam and I have been able to make a difference. I think we have shown you can make a difference, no matter how young you are." Vicky, Seb's mum, said, "The boys set themselves a huge challenge, and the weather was not on their side. But what made Seb go out running in the wind, snow and rain was he absolutely loves what the World Land Trust do. He knew that for every £100 him and Sam raised, he was saving half a football pitch of threatened habitats. The World Land Trust has given the boys so much support, and we really hope others are inspired to get behind this amazing charity." And the story is accompanied by a picture of Seb and Sam. They're crouching down with two cricket bats, two blue cricket bats with green handles, a red cricket ball and some stumps. And they're wearing a cricket gear as well and looking like they're really proud of what they've done.
Visitors to Verulamium Park are being strongly advised not to scale the Roman wall after a member of the public witnessed another person using the precious ruins to cycle along and perform bike tricks off. The man, who does not wish to be named, witnessed the cyclist riding along the top of the ruins of the Roman wall on his mountain bike on February the 8th. A second man was also on a bike near the wall, but remained on the cycle path. The unnamed man asked the biker to stop riding over the ruins, but he politely responded that he had a right to ride along it. The witness emailed St Albans Council in 2013, voicing his concerns of members of the public walking along the wall, and called for the reinstatement of the low fence round the ruin, as well as the addition of some signage. The man told the Hearts ad, "I just thought it was unbelievable, really. I never thought I'd actually see someone riding a bike over the ruins. I just thought people would be walking over and dislodging the stones. It's unbelievable that somebody would actually ride a bike over the ruins, and that's going to make it even worse." English Heritage's Free Sites coordinator Katie Charnes said, "The Roman ruins in Verulamium Park are a scheduled monument protected in law under the Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act, and using them in this way is clearly unacceptable. We would urge everyone using the park to make sure they are doing so in a way which respects its unique archaeology." Councillor Anthony Rowlands, portfolio holder for Leisure Heritage and Public Realm for St Albans Council, said, "We thank the resident for bringing this abuse of the Roman wall to our attention. I am appalled that someone would ride a mountain bike across these precious ruins and urge anyone who can identify them to report them to the police, as they may be guilty of an offence such as criminal damage. If anyone sees something like this happening again, I would ask them to report the incident to the police immediately on 101. The vast majority of Verulamium Park users are very respectful of the ruins and want to keep their city's heritage in excellent condition. I'm sure they will support all our efforts to do so."
Tenacity from Sandringham School in St Albans have created a downloadable activity pack to help primary school children learn and have fun in lockdown. With parents across the county and country yet again facing the tough task of homeschooling during lockdown, a troop of entrepreneurs from Sandringham School have formed to create a solution. The group of 26 Year 12 students who form the team Tenacity created their business to help primary school pupils and their parents through a downloadable activity pack as part of the Young Enterprise Company programme. The pack, which launched its first edition on Friday, February the 12th, is an affordable and entertaining online product and provides a virtual alternative to the usual way youngsters learn and play. With the help of Terry the Tenacious Tiger, children guided through a range of activities on the variety of school subjects. Three more editions will be available in the near future. The packs, priced at £1.99 each, can be purchased at tenacity-store.webflow.lo. And there's a lovely picture of most of the students posing for a photo.
Harpenden has been named one of the top locations for shopping in GB. The town ranked ninth in a list of 1,000 retail centres compiled by strategic retail property consultancy Harper Dennis Hobbs, or HDH in brackets, climbing 130 places compared to last year's rankings. The HDH Vitality Ranking determines the health of high streets and shopping centres, including the change in residents' movement, vacancy rates, and suitability to local consumers' demands. Bucks Market Town, Beaconsfield, topped the list, one of many smaller accessible commuter belt locations which have outperformed city centre destinations as consumers' shopping habits have become very localised due to the pandemic. St Albans was 32 on the list, falling 13 places from last year. Andy Metherell, head of retail consultancy at HDH, explained, "Our analysis is unique, as we use variables that both consumers and retailers consider when assessing shopping locations to rank the top 1,000 retail centres in Great Britain. This vitality ranking looks very different from previous years, as the retail health of high streets across the country has seen contrasting fortunes since the start of the pandemic. The most vital retail centres currently provide services that are essential to people's lives, such as grocers and pharmacies. These essential retailers have been able to trade throughout the strictest lockdowns, and consumers have not been willing or able to travel far to visit these stores. Shopping patterns have therefore changed significantly since the start of the pandemic, and consumers' local high streets are benefiting at the expense of major destinations." Dan Hildyard, head of UK retail at HDH, added, "More restricted consumer shopping habits have had an enormous impact on the relative success of high streets this year, with a shift to home working encouraging residents to reconnect with their local community. Affluence is a factor here, and some consumers are protected from job losses seen in other industries. While city centre destinations have suffered from travel restrictions and the absence of office workers, the fundamental strengths of these locations remain, and we expect them to bounce back over the course of this year in line with restrictions being eased. These centres are also leisure and culture hotspots, and many will be looking forward to returning when it is safe to do so. The results have been welcomed locally in Harpenden." Ron Taylor, on behalf of the Harpenden Society, said, "The Harpenden High Street, including the Southdown shops, has always been considered as a real gem for local residents. a treasure trove of independent shops with a fine balance of multiples and supermarkets, all blended together in a glorious setting with green spaces intermingling with pubs, coffee bars and restaurants. A number of the progressive owners have already adapted their businesses to offer an online platform or, in the case of hospitality, takeaway services. The necessity of lockdowns has had a detrimental effect on turnovers, however, and the ongoing issues of high rent and rates will continue to cause problems for long-term survival. I think everyone in Harpenden is looking forward to the ending of lockdowns so they can return to town to shop and socialise like never before. That's if they can find somewhere to park. Harpenden Mayor Councillor Nicola Lineker added, "It is great to see Harpenden performing well in these rankings, as we know there are many local people and organisations that have been working hard to make our retail areas vibrant, attractive and safe places. However, we are mindful that for many independent businesses, the past year has been very tough and there is still a lot of uncertainty about what the future holds. Once restrictions are lifted, it is vital that the town comes together to support these businesses that do so much for our community."
Introducing the Tour de Rennygrove Cycle Challenge fundraiser. Rennygrove Hospice Care is launching an exciting new cycling event in June this year, which will give both beginner and experienced cyclists the opportunity to take in the beautiful scenery and help to raise funds by riding through the local areas the charity's nurses regularly work in. The event will be held virtually over three consecutive weekends beginning on the 12th and 13th of June. The route for each of the three legs of the tour will be based in an area of Buckinghamshire or West Hertfordshire that the charity's nurses drive every day while delivering vital hospice at home care for people with life-limiting illnesses. Senior Challenge and Events fundraiser Emily Elvin said, "We love the idea of people cycling along the roads that our nurses use every day. We hope it will give our fundraisers and supporters some perspective on the miles that our nurses cover to deliver our care every day of the year. Each route will be approximately 50 miles in length. The riders are able to choose to do one leg or the full tour. The registration fee per leg is £10 or £25 for the entire tour. Participants will also receive the first ever Tour de Rennygrove branded cycling jersey. The charity is asking cyclists to aim to raise £1 per mile cycled, but there is no limit and it is encouraging people to raise as much as they can. For every £50 raised, almost 2 hours of care will be funded, so it really will be making a difference. Those who reach their fundraising target will also receive a medal to celebrate their achievement." Emily added, "We are confident that our supporters will smash their fundraising targets and aim even higher. The more we raise, the more hours of nursing care we can fund throughout the local community. The first leg of the Tour de Rennygrove will take place on June the 12th to the 13th, with a second leg on the 19th to the 20th of June, and a third on the 26th to the 27th of June. Registration will remain open until June the 11th.
Students in St Albans have teamed up to collectively thank the NHS with a Blue Heart mural. The project by Sandringham School was inspired by ongoing campaigns to thank the NHS online with the Blue Heart symbol and involved each student making a heart. Encouraged to be creative with their designs, the project began as a starter activity to kick off remote design technology lessons and quickly snowballed into a project involving students across all years at the school. Submitting their entries via Padlet, a digital platform used for making mood boards and sharing content in real time, students displayed a range of skills and techniques using a variety of materials and mediums to create their hearts. Some students opted for traditional fine art techniques such as watercolour or pen and ink, while others created digital designs. Some even used 3D materials they had at home, such as Lego and the contents of their recycling bin, with others wrapping up and braving the freezing temperatures to create hearts in the snow. Some students baked and made hearts that were good enough to eat. When introduced to the project, students were really keen to express their thanks to frontline workers. Design, technology and art teacher Trudy Barrow said, "I was so impressed with the variety of techniques and skills that you Design, technology and art teacher Trudy Barrow said, "I was so impressed with the variety of techniques and skills the students chose to use. It was really touching to hear how passionate the students were in wanting to thank the NHS and frontline workers." Year 9 student Melissa Graham said, "The NHS Blue Hearts project has been wonderful to contribute to. Our school community has been brought together through creating unique and individual heart designs in order to commemorate the extraordinary NHS. This project is important because it allows us to express our gratitude to the incredible workers who have given us their time and support. The NHS have done so much for everyone over the past year and deserve to be recognised for their hard work." Fellow Year 9 pupil Abigail Vetch added, "The Blue Hearts project is an incredible gesture of gratitude to be part of creating, as it demonstrates just how thankful we are to the NHS for the incredible work they've been doing in keeping us all safe over the past year, in a creative way that binds the school community together." And accompanying this article is a picture of this amazing mural created by the students and saying across the top, "Thank you from all of us at Sandringham School," with a kiss.
This article is about road closures, asking, is permanent pedestrianisation a possibility? City centre road closures introduced to promote social distancing proved divisive when they were brought into force last year, but it now seems the majority are in favour of permanent pedestrianisation. High Street, George Street and Marketplace in St Albans have remained shut to traffic since the first lockdown restrictions were eased in May, after Herts County Council brought in the measures to prevent crowded pavements in the vicinity. The closures provoked a backlash from local retailers. Mike Skinner, who owns Masters in Light, said the closures were having a negative effect on his business and predicted last June that they were the first steps towards permanent pedestrianisation. Like many other nearby shop owners, he said deliveries were a major problem. Derianne Tad of the Dressing Room in High Street said local businesses were not adequately consulted about the original plans, but thought a proper pedestrianised area would be a welcomed addition to the Cathedral Quarter. After initial complaints about a lack of proper signage and accessibility issues, improvements were made, including the introduction of wooden barriers filled with flowers to brighten up the area. County Councillor Sandy Walkington sold the Hearts ad. "After some initial hiccups, the initial feedback from this forced experiment is hugely encouraging. There is a tremendous opportunity here. But all the stakeholders, including the Cathedral, St Albans School and residents and businesses impacted by displaced traffic, must feel comfortable that they have been heard." Local organisations like St Albans Civic Society and the neighbourhood groups Abbey Precincts Residents Association and Fishpool Streets Residents Association have surveyed their members about the closures to find out whether they wanted them to become permanent. In 89 responses received from APRA members, the most popular option was for George Street to remain pedestrianised and High Street to be closed to all but designated traffic, including buses, taxis and delivery vehicles at specified times. Meanwhile, FRSA members received 81 responses to its survey, which proposed a combined approach to the issue of city centre traffic management and saw overwhelming positive support for measures, including George Street and Marketplace remaining as permanent pedestrianised areas, with direct vehicle access for deliveries restricted to specific off-peak times. It also called for a new loading bay and drop-off area at the junction of Verulam Road and High Street to be used for pupils of St Albans School and delivery drivers, controlled access to High Street for licensed vehicles at certain times of the day, making the central section of Flispool Street one way east to west to avoid it being used as a rat run, and a robustly enforced 20-mile-an-hour speed limit through the city centre. Sarah Gillow, co-vice-chair of St Albans BID and owner of Gallio Jewellers, said, "We are very excited about the overall positive feedback for the permanent closure of George Street and also how HCC have managed to facilitate the access needs of some of the businesses. There has been a call for creating a cathedral quarter for some time. The pedestrianisation is a step towards that. It has made the area feel more of a community. It has united the neighbourhood and created an amazing atmosphere with greater footfall, albeit socially distant. George Street is a hub for independent businesses heavily hit in this pandemic. By creating a unique and buzzy atmosphere, safe from cars and traffic, the businesses will be able to trade inside and outside safely, which will no doubt help future-proof their development." Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Businesses, Tourism and Culture on St Albans District Council, has been working on the next steps. HCC has agreed that once we are through the COVID crisis, they will work with the county councillors, the BID and myself to bring together a stakeholder group with representatives to find a way forward, to move forward that will hopefully work for everyone. I think that it's fair to say we all think the support for the permanent pedestrianisation of George Street is very positive. And working in partnership, we hope for a practical, viable pedestrianisation plan for our city centre that balances the needs of all stakeholders, with a need to be more climate, pedestrian and cyclist friendly, and helps draw more visitor footfall to our city. But not everyone likes the closures. A petition by George Street Antique Dealers L.A. James calling on the County Council to reverse the scheme has more than 400 signatures.
"We can't expunge history," says landlord of the Black Boy pub. A Bricketwood pub has firmly stated that it has no intention to change its name after others with the same name made the change due to racial connotations. The Hearts ad approached the Black Boy pub after Green King institutions bearing the same name were renamed last week as part of the retailer's move to become a truly anti-racist organisation. The Bricketwood pub, commonly referred to as The Boy, will not change its name, with landlord Peter Dillingham stating that "you cannot expunge history." Peter appeared on BBC One's The One Show in August 2020, alongside Kevin Dwala, as part of the exploration of the history behind the controversial name. "We've got no plans to change the name here," Peter said. "There have been many reasons why people think we're called the Black Boy, but in that episode, they got a historian down who is a specialist in pubs' names, and she told us the reason why it's called the Black Boy. A lot of people thought it was named after King Charles, because his mum called him the Black Boy due to his very dark complexion. Others believe it may have been named after chimney sweeps, but the actual name derives from an advertisement. It meant that, in this place, you could buy anything that came from the plantations, tobacco, cotton, all those sort of things. You could buy them in this particular shop." Peter went on to explain that as many people were illiterate, the names and signs of shops were an important way of relaying to customers what a business sold. Peter became the landlord of the now 270-year-old pub in 2001. Which boasts an annual music festival, aptly named Bricket Woodstock, and is home to darts and football teams. He noted the diversity of pubgoers that frequent his business, despite the name it bears, stating he has never known anyone to be offended by it or mention it in a derogatory manner. "We can't just wipe out things we don't like because we don't like them anymore. History is how we learn. What we can do is educate people that in today's diverse societies and cultures, racism has no part.
A St Albans Dance Academy achieved a 100% pass rate for students during lockdown, with all exams taken via video. Brewer Dance Academy celebrated its success in the September 2020 Royal Academy of Dance exams, recognised internationally as a high standard measure of graded dancing achievement. The school, known originally as the Stephanie Ledger School of Dancing, has been running since 1972. In 2014, the business was taken over by former professional dancer and long-term teacher Helen Brewer. Due to the pandemic, new measures were put in place to enable RAD examinations to continue, with individual candidate performances required to be submitted by video as examiners were unable to travel due to lockdown restrictions. For the first time in its dancing history, the Brewer Dance Academy quickly trained both teaching staff and candidates on how to film practices and submit final examinations. Strict guidelines had to be adhered to, including location risk assessments, minimum level quality audio and video output, as well as creating an examination room setting. Over 70 pupils were entered for graded exams ranging from primary level, usually taken aged from as young as 4, to grade 8, generally taken by candidates at 16 or older. Owner Helen said, "We have seen such resilience among our pupils, using all kinds of home equipment to help keep up their weekly ballet practice, from dining room chairs and bunk beds for bar work, to working on point in their bedrooms and living rooms. On finding out that every single one of our 70 candidates had passed, I felt so happy. It really was an achievement I would not have thought possible this time last year. 100% success after a summer in lockdown and a rush to get filming done before the second lockdown has been quite a challenge." With some teachers in self-isolation and others quickly getting to grips with new technology, they still managed to create a wide range of teaching materials by recording exercises and lesson plans from their own family homes. Teacher Catherine Cole explained, "We were sad to be starting 2021 back in lockdown, but all of our pupils have been fantastic at attending Zoom lessons online from home. They come dressed for ballet with the mindset that they are practicing in a normal lesson. The only challenges can be for us teaching from a chilly hall in winter and the often untrustworthy Wi-Fi we rely on to deliver the full timetable of lessons. Pupils of BDA pupils have been extremely grateful for the lessons continuing. Emily Kennedy, mother of grade 4 BDA student Lily, said, "We are so grateful to Mrs. Brewer and her team for enabling our youngsters to dance their way through lockdown." Lily's lessons are the highlight of her week, and to be able to log in to see familiar, cheery faces dancing in unison to the beautiful music of a live pianist has helped keep her spirits up when so much of normal life has been paused. "Students had worked so hard to prepare for their exams, and we never imagined they'd be able to complete them virtually. These superb results are testament to Mrs. Brewer's great adaptability and dedication." Emma Thompson, mother of grade 3 exam student Olivia, said, "As a working parent, online ballet lessons have been extremely welcome, especially when homeschooling started up again. Ballet has been one of the few forms of exercise that Olivia could continue in lockdown, and it has really helped break up the long winter days when she's been attending lessons online, sitting down all day." Mum Joanna Bowness said, "My daughter loves dance, and without it, lockdown would have been so much harder for her to deal with. So many of the children are working towards their next exams and will now still be able to take them and progress to their next grade, which is just fantastic. Mother of two, Christina Smith, added, "Ballet coming back during lockdown was a lifesaver. A small glimpse of some normal in an upside-down world. Mrs. Brewer has been wonderful in keeping us COVID safe, but also making sure the girls had fun." And this article is accompanied by two photos of pupils from Brewer Dance Academy doing their practice at home, with two of them holding on to the mantelpiece instead of holding on to their bar.
Remembering Mac, the hurdy-gurdy man. Not everyone can say they have directly influenced the Beatles, but that's a legacy of one legendary St. Albans musician who's died at the age of 79. Mac McLeod, who was born Keith, also spent time touring with his friend Donovan, who recently published a poem to acknowledge the guitarist's skills, which he generously passed on to famous artists. Mac, who lived at the Berries, was known on the St. Albans music scene and hung around with the Zombies, the Kinks and Donovan in the 1960s. Highlights of his career include supporting Pink Floyd, making it into top industry magazines NME and Melody Maker, and he indirectly taught George Harrison to play guitar. He's publicly acknowledged to have passed some of his guitar skills and knowledge to Scottish singer-songwriter Donovan in the 1960s. The pair toured together multiple times and remained friends. They performed a memorable gig at the 1965 NME Awards, where they shared the bill with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. At the time, Donovan told press, "The man who encouraged and helped me most was a fellow called Keith Mac McLeod. I've known him for about 3 years, and he's taught me everything from chord progressions on the guitar to how to appreciate folk and real blues." Donovan's famous 1968 hit, Hurdy Gurdy Man, which reached number 4 in the UK charts, was written about Mac, who taught him specialist guitar techniques when they were in bands together. Mac was in a band called Hurdy Gurdy in Denmark when Donovan was with the Beatles in India, where he wrote the song. George Harrison wrote an extra verse for it that remained unheard until Mac recorded an updated version for his anthology in 2002. And his Beatles associations didn't stop there. Mac is recognised to have contributed to the guitar playing of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, whose finger-picking style on the White Album was learned in India from Donovan. Donovan had originally been taught that skill by Mac. The old friends were reunited when Donovan invited Mac to join him on stage at a concert in Oxford in 2006. After a period away from the industry, Mac marked his return in 2002 with a career-spanning anthology, including new recordings with a new band featuring former Zombies and Kinks bassist Jim Rodford. Jim's son Steve, now the Zombies drummer, produced the new tracks. He said, "Mac was a very special man, legend and guru. He was an old mate of my dad's from school. It was great that years later, when I was playing drums and producing him in the studio, I got my dad in on bass." A talented folk and blues guitarist and songwriter, Mac appeared at the Cock, the Horn and the Peahen in St. Albans with many local musicians in several bands over decades. His diverse expertise extended to other genres, including heavy rock and sitar-drenched psychedelia in the early 1970s band Amber. He provided bass with top group Argent, fronted by the ex-Zombies Rod Argent. His work involved collaborations with folk legends Maddy Pryor and John Renbourn, with whom Mac recorded recently. Mac also played flute with new age band Maya in the early 2000s. Band member John Tobin said, "It meant so much to us when he agreed to join us on stage at our first public concert. We played without a rehearsal. He was so encouraging and supportive and transported the audience somewhere else when he got going on that flute. We'll all miss him, but he leaves an incredible legacy in his music that will live on." Mac had been suffering for 6 years with tuberculosis, emphysema and cancer, for which he was being treated in hospital when he died of pneumonia in November. Bill Johnson runs the Blue Angel Acoustic Night at the Horn Pub in Victoria Street. It's currently suspended because of the pandemic. Bill best remembers Mac from when he performed with Ugly and the Beast, also featuring Ruth Tidmarsh. He said, "My fondest memory of him is when he played flute with us. His incredible playing totally transformed the songs. He was a great intuitive musician with real sensitivity and feel. Sail on, Mr. Mac." Mac married Stella in 1964, separating 15 years later, but remaining friends. He leaves two children and five grandchildren. And the article is accompanied by a picture of Mac McLeod from 2012. And it shows him smiling with a guitar and a microphone stand, looking like he's about to perform.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, February 20th. The drama on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. is the first of a two-part dramatisation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Beautiful and Damned, which charts the jazz age via a glamorous but doomed marriage. On Radio 4 Extra at 4, there's Sea Fever, a comic thriller. When Dennis Viner's financial empire collapses, there's only one thing left to do, disappear. But he needs the help of his wife and his girlfriend. If you're an opera fan, you can start the week in dramatic style with Opera on 3 at 5 p.m. Goethe a Demerung, the climax of Wagner's Ring Cycle. Back to Radio 4 at 8 p.m. for Meeting Myself Coming Back, in which double Olympic gold winner Dame Kelly Holmes looks back through the archives to relive key moments of her career. Finally, still on Radio 4 at 9:45, The Y Factor looks at the circus and wonders why, in a world of screens, streaming video and TV on demand, the circus continues to endure. Moving on to Sunday, February 21st, in Desert Island Discs on Radio 4 at 11 a.m, Lauren Laverne's guest is Sophia Loren. It's followed at 11:45, still on Radio 4, by The Battles That Won Our Freedoms, which this week looks at freedom of association and examines how Victorian working men struggled to form unions with real power. At 2:20 on Radio 4 Extra, Writing the Century, Land's End to John O'Groats, is George Allen's 1904 diary of his record-attempting walk to promote the benefits of vegetarianism. Back on Radio 4 at 2:45, the final part of Disability, A New History, is called A Disabled Identity. Peter White reveals the birth of a modern disabled identity in the 19th century through the lives of two blind women who fought the conventions of their time. The drama at 3 on Radio 4 is the second of three parts of Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And there's more drama on Radio 3 at 7:30 with French Like Pfizer. Pfizer is French of Algerian descent and moves to London hoping to reset her life. But when she meets Mehdi, a British Pakistani, Pfizer soon discovers that Britain is far from the land of butterflies and rainbows she had imagined. Then at 7:45, back on Radio 4, the short story in the series The Last Resort is Kathleen by Jan Carson. A doting grandmother is excited to show off the new baby to her neighbours. Onto those programmes then, which are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday. Same radio station, same time, every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. 9:45 a.m, Radio 4, and repeated at 12:30 each day, the book of the week is Bessie Smith, in which Scotland's national poet Jackie Kay mixes biography, fiction, music and memoir to paint a portrait of the tempestuous life of the blues singer. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 on Radio 4 and repeated at 7:45 is Little Blue Lines, Kate Rawson's bleaky, funny and frank drama based on a blog she wrote about her anxiety during pregnancy after having previously two miscarriages. On Radio 3 at 12 noon, composer of the week is Felix Mendelssohn, focusing on the final 5 years in the life of the composer, who died at just the age of 38. Just after midday on Radio 4, and then repeated at 10:45 each night, Monday through to Friday, on the same radio station all week, you can hear Small Pleasures by Claire Chambers. In 1950s southeast London, Jean, who works at a local newspaper, while also caring for her neurotic mother, is sent to investigate claims a woman has given birth without the involvement of a man. At 1:45 on Radio 4, a series called Nature Bang looks at the natural world. The first part on Monday is called, intriguingly, Dog Poo and the Challenge of Navigation, and it's described as a story of the sun, the stars, magnetic fields, polarised light, and you guessed it, dog poo. On Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m, Dirt Road is an adaptation of the 2016 novel by 1994 Booker Prize winner James Kelman. Talented young musician Murdo, reeling from a family bereavement, prepares to leave the west coast of Scotland for an American road trip with his father. All week, same time, Radio 4 Extra, 2 p.m. And wrapping up the week's highlights, Classic FM concert every day, every night, with John Suchet at 8 p.m. This week looks at some of the works which were noticeably absent from the Hall of Fame list last year. Here are some individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, February 22nd. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4, in the series My Name Is, the subject is Richard, a gamekeeper and special constable with Hertfordshire Constabulary, who's increasingly angry about the rise in rural crime and its impact on countryside communities. On Radio 4 at 2:15 is Murmuration, a darkly comic and heartwarming drama. Barnaby hears voices in his head. When he meets a friendly neighbour, they begin to bond over the birds that visit their block of flats. But Barnaby hits crisis point with his voices, who want to keep him all to themselves. Staying on Radio 4 at 4:30, The Digital Human explores the power of toys and play in shaping our technological future. At 6:30 on Radio 4, there's the first in a new series of Just a Minute, with Paul Merton, Sheila Hancock, Giles Brandeth, Tony Hawks and Pippa Evans. And turn to Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 for High Table Lower Orders, Series 1 of Mark Tevener's comedy drama Murder Mystery from 2005, set in a fictitious Cambridge college, with Geoffrey Palmer, Samuel West and Rebecca Front. Tuesday, February 23rd, the Radio 4 drama at 2:15 is Writ in Water, marking the 200th anniversary of the death of poet John Keats. After a lifetime of illness, Keats is persuaded by his doctors to travel to Italy in the hope the warmer climate will improve his poor health. Back to Radio 4 at 3 p.m. for the second of seven instalments of Shortcuts, which this week looks at correspondence. Josie Long presents short documentaries about writing, from pen pals connecting across thousands of miles to the love letters that are cherished, hidden and also lost. Still on Radio 4 at 4 p.m, Born in Bradford, a programme which the Radio Times describes in Today's Choices as a difficult but important listen. Winifred Robinson makes the annual report on one of the largest longitudinal studies in the world that since 2007 has been tracking 14,000 children and reporting on factors affecting health and well-being. The first children recruited are now teenagers, and the programme investigates the impact of lockdown life on them. Over on Radio 3 at 10 p.m, Free Thinking explores the thinking and poetic writing of theologian and priest John Henry Newman, who in 2019 was canonised as a saint in the Catholic Church. Wednesday, February 24th at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 in Will Self Takes the Waters. This week the presenter looks at how Buxton rose to prominence as a spa town in the 18th and 19th centuries. Still on Radio 4 at 2:15 is The Fall Down. In this three-part drama, seven mysterious women arrive on our planet without fanfare and without a spaceship. They apparently offer incredible solutions to the world's problems, but who are they and what do they want? Parts 2 and 3 can be heard at the same time on Thursday and Friday. Choral Evensong at 3:30 on Radio 3 is a service from February 2013 from the Chapel of King's College, London. And back to Radio 4 in the evening at 8:45 for the first in a new series of Lent Talks, a personal hopeful reflection called A Letter to Lydia. In a letter written to his daughter Lydia, who was born during the pandemic, Manchester-based intensive care doctor Mark Tan describes the last 12 months working on the front line. And at 9 p.m, again on Radio 4, the last in the series, The Power Of, looks at night, exploring the evolutionary advantages of nocturnal animals. Thursday, February 25th, all of the choices can be heard on Radio 4. From our own correspondent at 11 a.m, introduced by Kate Adey. Followed at 11:30 by John Keats' Life and Afterlife, which focuses on Keats' death in Rome and the myths that began to develop immediately afterwards. At 3 p.m, still on Radio 4, Ramblings. Sculptor Simon Gudgeon invites Claire Balding on a walk from the historic St Nicholas Church in Moreton, Dorset, to his home set in his own sculpture park, Sculpture by the Lakes in Pallington. At 4:30, the presenters of BBC Inside Science explore the latest scientific research. And lastly, to finish our day on Radio 4, still at 6:30, Between Ourselves with Marion Keyes. The author reads selections from her non-fiction writing in the company of her friend, the actor Tara Flynn. So to Friday, February 26th, and the end of another week, Radio 4, 11 a.m, Britain's Fascist Thread explores a century of British fascism, from the formation of the British Fascisti in 1923 through Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists, the National Front, the BNP, to diffuse groupings of the internet age. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 at 2 p.m. features works by Schubert, Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, plus a new work by Gillian Whitehead. Radio 4 Extra at 3, a dramatisation of Keats' epic poem, The Eve of St Agnes, a gothic fantasy in which the heroine Madeline hopes to be visited on St Agnes's Eve by the vision of the man she is to marry. Finally, if you have digital radio, and many of us do, on the BBC World Service at 8:30, this week's Crowd Science programme has the title Why Do Men Rule the World? And looks at research into gender inequality. That's it for another week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts ad. Feed the birds and they'll reward you. This week I have bought a new bird feeding station for the garden. Once set up, it will be the second such feature in the garden and will hopefully attract a segment of birds I have until now been unable to draw in. The current feeder offers seed, peanuts and occasionally fat balls and is frequented by great blue and coal tits daily. Nuthatches and the occasional great spotted woodpecker also visit, and thanks to their messy feeding habits, dunnocks, robins and wood pigeons are well supplied from the food fall below. It seems nuthatches in particular are determined to pick out the juicy sunflower hearts, discarding all else, and reminds me of my eldest daughter flicking sultanas and raisins out of her cereal mix, a look of disdain on her face. My current feeder is situated close to the house and surrounded by bushes, but this, it seems, does not suit the finch family, with just fleeting visits from chaffinches and lesser redpolls in the past. These birds, along with greenfinches, goldfinches, siskins and the occasional bullfinch, do visit the garden but tend to stay at high level in the treetops. Of course, they are finding natural food, not least the plane tree's seed balls that the goldfinches love. But I can't help feeling they are also eyeing up my garden and its lack of feeder provision, and moving on to some more attentive neighbour's garden. No more, for I have visions of flocks of finches descending to gobble up the smorgasbord of provision that I am about to unleash. My motivation is, of course, mainly selfish, fuelled by visions of feeders loaded with birds put out there by the RSPB to generate enthusiasm for its annual Big Garden Birdwatch at the end of January. But my desires are also part prompted by the onset of severe cold weather, to which many birds are very vulnerable. First thing this morning, I watched a male blackbird visit a tray of water I had put out earlier in the year as a bird bath. I realised as it flew off that the water had frozen, and so I broke the ice, an inch thick, and watched again. Just a few minutes later and the blackbird was back, whereupon he enjoyed a long drink. While I might be taking pleasure from watching birds drink and bathe, it is easy to forget that for them these things are critical for survival. I'm not expecting any sudden influx of new birds, as it will take time for the contraption to be accepted, and for me to decide exactly where's best to put it. I'm hoping, however, that in time it will add to the variety, colour and activity within the garden, something that has become so cherished this last year. A bird feeder is a doorway, a portal into the garden from the wider wild outside, and provides the opportunity to change things up in the garden. I was reminded again just a few days ago of just how much joy birds can bring when all about is grey, cold and miserable, and threatening to cast a shadow on all within too. In anticipation of a roast dinner and log fire, I went out to do battle with a blizzard and walked until I was warm. The thin, icy layer of snow made every surface feel hard, cold, and impenetrable. Even in the shelter of some woods, the sounds of tiny goldcrests feeding in the tops of pines seemed to quiver and shiver with their movements. Watching them through binoculars and feeling their cold, I suddenly alighted on a vision of warmth. A beautiful male brambling, sitting against a pale backdrop of birch bark. His vibrant orange breast and yellow bill was like a burning flame in the cold. It was a rare treat, as bramblings only visit us in the winter, and often remain hidden within the more familiar chaffinch flocks. I had assumed the evening's food and fire comforts would warm me, but actually it was the brambling that really warmed my day from the inside out. I hope that it won't be too long before this little winter blaze of colour lights up my new garden bird feeder too.
Paralysed from the shoulders down in a car crash, Royston's Marianne Rupre has battled back to regain mobility and to help others. She has been named one of the top 100 most influential disabled people in the UK. The words are by Julie Lucas. At 27, Marianne Rupre felt she had it all. After spending time travelling and working in Australia, she'd recently started her own hospitality business with her partner and was making contact with sporting events. But on the 12th of June 2004, returning with her sister from a friend's wedding in the Cambridgeshire Fens, life threw a huge curveball. Driving along the lanes, the car slid and veered off the road. "I don't really remember anything, but take that as a positive," says Marianne. "One minute I was laughing, and the next minute I was in a hospital bed." She was rushed to intensive care at Peterborough City Hospital with a broken neck. Her family were told that if she was to survive, she would be paralysed from the shoulders down. Despite clinically dying on three occasions and being so high on a cocktail of drugs she thought the staff were robots, Marianne's instincts to survive kicked in. Fighting back from the brink, she was transferred to Sheffield's Princess Royal Spinal Cord Injuries Centre, and her journey to recovery began with months of intensive rehabilitation. "I was shocked and frightened," Marianne says. "I absolutely loved to party, dance and socialise, and I realised that would not happen in the way it used to." Despite her injuries, she confounded experts, breathing unaided earlier than doctors expected. But she admits she hit rock bottom in the early days. "I owe a lot to my partner, Andy, and his sister Sharon," Marianne explains. "I had to lie flat on my back for 3 months with weights bolted to my head, staring at the ceiling. It gave me a lot of time to think. At times I didn't want to go on, and I remember the first day I used a wheelchair, I just cried." It was during her 7 months of rehabilitation that a fellow patient in hospital with a similar injury inspired her to focus not just on herself, but on what she could do to make the lives of other paralysed people better. Unlike Marianne, the young girl's friends and family didn't visit, finding it too much. "Even on my darkest days, I was surrounded by people who loved me and wanted me to do well. It gave me a reason to carry on. This girl made us want to reach out to others and give them hope and a reason to find joy in life again." The year after her accident, Marianne and her partner, Andy Utteridge, founded the Rupre Spinal Trust, which helps make activity-based physiotherapy more accessible. The charity supports research in areas like cell therapy, exercise science, neuroregeneration, and fertility. It also includes research into neurological physiotherapy, activity-based physio to kickstart pathways in the central nervous system that have been damaged, to try to improve limb function, loss of balance, walking, pain, and even reverse paralysis. It's an activity-based physio that Marianne loves and has helped her to regain some mobility. "I can propel my own chair, send my own texts, and I can reach my nose to scratch an itch. Massive goals that are life-changing. Of course, I'll still have a high level of disability, but the goals I have achieved have changed my life. Keeping fit and healthy and working out is important to me, but neurophysio is far more than that. It's about looking after the paralysed muscles as well as the functional muscles." The Rupre Spinal Trust, RST, has raised more than £1 million for equipment, improving the quality of life for many with spinal cord injuries. And Marianne inspires her many followers on Instagram, but she insists that Andy and Sharon have been very much the brains behind the charity. Their passion to help people affected by spinal cord injury is infectious, says Marianne. RST continues to grow every year, and I'm blown away by what we've achieved so far. Our physio scholarship program is open to anyone in the UK who has a spinal cord injury and is in need of some help to access physio. On top of our program, we have people from all over the world contacting us, asking for advice and questions. I enjoy sharing my approach to dealing with paralysis. Nobody has all the answers, but sharing is caring for sure. I speak to a lot of people one-to-one, and I've been to visit a lot of people new to spinal cord injury. It also includes working closely with the Special Therapy Centre, Prime Physio, in Melbourne, Royston. Marianne was the first person in the world with C4 level spinal cord injury to use an ESCO machine, a wearable robotic exoskeleton that allowed her to walk. "The first time I walked in the exo was very emotional," says Marianne. "It was the first time I could stand and hug my family. It was also amazing to look at people in the eye again, rather than looking up all the time. I think exoskeletons are a brilliant rehab device, but they're a long way from being a mobility replacement for a wheelchair." Marianne believes that physiotherapy has had a huge impact, not just on her body, but on her mind since her injury. "When I left the spinal unit, paralysed from the shoulders down," she says, "I began a journey to see what was out there that would help me to improve. It wasn't about expecting to find some miracle instant cure. It was about trying to improve my situation. It was about making progress for my mind as well as my body. In 2005, there wasn't much available to people with spinal cord injuries in terms of therapy as there is today. It still has a long way to go, but it has improved a lot. It's not about the miracles," she continues. "It's about the positive impact it can have on your life after paralysis. Sadly, not everyone can afford access to specialist physiotherapy, so they miss out. Many are told that there's no point if you're paralysed. They're wrong. I want to keep pushing the importance of neurophysiotherapy for mind and body after paralysis. I want to continue helping others enjoy the benefit I've been lucky enough to explore." Marianne has now gained function in her arms, although not yet in her hands. She has improved her core strength and has built up a decent pair of biceps by incorporating a functional electrical stimulation rowing, a treatment that uses small electrical charges to improve mobility, into her workout. "Just because I'm in a wheelchair, I still want to look good and look after myself," she says. Now 43 and living in Royston, Marianne has been recognised for her dedication to helping others with her inclusion in the Sure Trust Power 100, an annual publication of the 100 most influential disabled people in the UK. She joins the likes of disability campaigner Baroness Jane Campbell and Paralympic athlete Baroness Tanny Gray Thompson. "When I heard the news, I cried," she admits. "It's a huge honour to be included in the list," she adds with a laugh. "I must admit, I certainly don't feel powerful." She says the team that helped her are over the moon with how she approached dealing with paralysis. "Everybody is different, but I didn't want to waste the opportunity they'd given me. I'll be forever grateful to the wonderful doctors and nurses who saved me and gave me a second chance at life." Does she think the society's perception of disability has changed since her accident in 2004? "Things have improved since I was first injured, but I still think there's a long way to go before people with disabilities are seen as equal. People with disabilities don't want special treatment. They just want to be treated on the same level as everybody else. If I go to a restaurant, for example, I want to be able to visit the bathroom like everyone else does. I don't want to hear there isn't an accessible bathroom or see that it doubles up as a store cupboard. I'm lucky that I have an amazing support team around me, which means we can go out and overcome most situations that come my way. But those situations could be avoided easily if society was more inclusive. Many people with disabilities don't have the support I have, which means it's harder for them to overcome the obstacles that everyday life throws at you, so they don't go out. They stay trapped in their home. That needs to change." Although the life path Marianne is now on is very different to the one she imagined, it's a path that brings happiness, and she still has Andy by her side. The couple have been together for 18 years and are now engaged. For me, a positive outlook is so important, she says. It doesn't mean you don't have down days, but it helps you to move past them and onto the good days. I have always had a zest for life, for having fun, for laughing, and I still do. There is life after paralysis.
Hello, I'm Bill, and this is a story from Hearts Life magazine called Hearts Cold War Secrets. It's by Sebastian Oak. I'm buried deep underground, encased in concrete, 15 stations across Hertfordshire were manned by teams poised to react to a nuclear strike on Britain. 3 decades after the fall of the Soviet Union, we lift the lid on the county's secret nuclear bunkers. Here and there across Hertfordshire, there are forgotten corners of fields where odd-looking concrete and metal objects rise discreetly from the ground. If you gave them a second glance, and you probably wouldn't, you might think they mark the site of a water storage tank, or perhaps something to do with gas, electricity, or telephone companies. However, these places have never had anything to do with providing modern utilities. Indeed, they were there to monitor their potential destruction. Underneath these unusual surface features lies a secret world. Monitoring posts created to measure the impact of a nuclear weapon strike on Britain. These rusting, waterlogged underground bunkers were once part of detailed preparations for nuclear war. This year marks 30 years since the dramatic collapse of the former Soviet Union, and with it the end of the Cold War. With reduced fears of a nuclear strike from Russia, the bunkers dotted around Hertfordshire, and indeed the UK, were decommissioned. During the Cold War, largely in the early 60s, around 1,500 monitoring posts were constructed in the UK for the UK Warning and Monitoring Organisation. 15 were built in Hearts, key to measuring any attack on the capital. They were staffed by volunteers, members of the Royal Observer Corps, the ROC. In a time of war, they would have had an intensely sobering job, measuring the force of a nuclear burst, the direction of its centre and the amount of radioactive fallout afterwards. The posts were not manned continuously, but in periods of international tension, teams of 3 were stationed at each one, waiting for the attack warning speaker on the wall to tell the news everyone dreaded. If it had done, the personnel would likely have needed to stay underground for several weeks. Taras Young, author of Nuclear War in the UK, says the UK government took the threat of nuclear attack very seriously during the Cold War. The network of ROC posts would have been extremely useful in pinpointing which areas had been hit, he says. The information they would have gathered would have meant the number of survivors could have been estimated and assistance sent to the right areas. Few people not involved in this process would have known anything about it. ROC members signed the Official Secrets Act and could not talk openly about their work. They were part of a clandestine world that was unsettling, even terrifying to those outside it. The origins of the ROC go back to 1925, and then during World War II, the Corps performed a vital role in identifying and tracking enemy aircraft. In the mid-1950s, with Cold War tensions rising, it took on the additional task of monitoring the impact of possible nuclear attack. Monitoring posts were rebuilt underground, well protected to resist bomb blasts. By the mid-60s, radar technology had improved to the extent that ROC volunteers were no longer needed for aircraft monitoring, and posts focused entirely on the nuclear threat. This continued until 1991, when the remaining bunkers were shut down and the ROC volunteers largely let go. In the past 30 years since then, monitoring posts have passed into the hands of private landowners. Some have been demolished or filled in, while many have just been left to drift quietly into history. A small number are being preserved by enthusiasts. They are, as you might expect, generally impregnable and inaccessible. But if you could lift the heavy lid on the entrance shaft, you would find beneath evidence of a dark political undercurrent to what were, after all, frighteningly recent times. A metal ladder in a vertical shaft led down to a small subterranean room encased in reinforced concrete. Here, furniture was limited to a table, chairs, bunk beds, and a cupboard with provisions to outlast, they hoped, any nuclear fallout. Drinking water was stored in jerry cans. Food was in the form of service ration packs. A separate area housed a chemical toilet. Electricity came from a heavy-duty battery, periodically charged by a portable petrol-driven generator. It was cramped, chilly, and damp. A pump was installed should water accumulate on the floor. Each monitoring post had three main pieces of equipment, with mundane yet terrifying names. The bomb power indicator would register the pressure wave from a nuclear blast passing over an instrument on the surface, while the ground zero indicator would photograph the fireball of an explosion and record its direction. The radiation meter recorded subsequent fallout levels. Those who manned the monitoring posts were extremely dedicated people, Taras says, who felt they were working for a greater good, even being prepared to leave their families during a crisis to serve their country. One man familiar with the Hertfordshire bunkers is Richard Slatter. In 1993, he bought his own, the Ashwell ROC monitoring post that had been stood down 2 years earlier. I paid £1,115 for it. A bargain. Actually, it cost me more than that because I had to buy my wife a new coat and bedroom in compensation. I hadn't told her. Most of the village knew before she did. The Ashwell post opened in 1960 and closed at the general stand down 31 years later. It was staffed by members of the village community, including Hugh Jarman, Peter King and David Swallow. Richard now has passed the bunker on to a private owner, but during the time it was in his hands, he opened it to the public for the annual Ashwell at Home event. He also once lent it to the Stevenage Amateur Radio Society for a contest, and even made it available to Stevenage Sword Dancers, a folk dance society with swords, as an unusual setting for what must have been a compact performance. If that sounds eccentric, then perhaps a slightly crazy event is suitable for what might be seen as a decidedly mad place. Across Hearts and the UK, the remaining ROC monitoring posts stand as reminders of a period when nuclear tension and attack were a real and present fear. They stand as monuments, thankfully, to a war that never came. We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Anne, Dominic, Caroline, Jilly and Sue, and of course John for the radio listings, and Rupert for his nature notes. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in February 2021. We close with Farah's medley of Where's Neil, Up Dust Drood, and The Man Who Shot the Windmills. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.